What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hi there, how are you all? Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast, brought to you by Kraken, the best place to buy, sell, and trade digital currencies. I'm your host, Peter McCormack, and today I have the third interview in my Mt. Gox series, an interview with lawyer Daniel Kelman, the architect of the civil rehabilitation plan for the creditors of Mt. Gox. But before that, I have a message from my show sponsors. So, BlockFi, right? You know these. I've been talking about them for so long. Have you checked them out? Have you been to their website yet? If you are interested in a crypto-backed loan, you know by now that BlockFi is the leading crypto to USD lender. They service customers worldwide. They cover 47 states in the US, and their interest rates are now as low as 4.5%. Also, BlockFi accepts Bitcoin, Ether, or Litecoin as collateral. And if you're a customer, you can get funded in USD or GUSD, which is Gemini's dollar-backed stablecoin, and you can go from application to funding in as little as 30 minutes. If you head over to blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid, you can get $25 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans for under $10,000, or $50 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans over $10,000, and applying takes less than 2 minutes. That is blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid, which is blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid. And also, we need to talk about the mighty Cash App again. And as I said to them before, a massive thanks to them for supporting my work this week with the special Mt. Gox shows. So, what is Cash App? Do you know it? Have you downloaded it? Have you got it on your phone yet? I have. It's pretty cool. Cash App is the first traditional peer-to-peer payments app to support Bitcoin, and it comes with most of the features of a traditional bank account. You've got the ability to direct debit your paycheck into the app. You get a physical customizable debit card, which is linked to your account to spend from. And you have the ability to earn 10% back at places like Whole Foods with the Cash Boost. That can be used in tandem with your Bitcoin balance. It's available on Apple and the Google Play stores. You can download it by searching for Cash App, which is C-A-S-H-A-P-P. Just a note though, Bitcoin buying is only available in the US right now. So, on to my interview with Daniel. And while he might not have the profile of the likes of Jed McCaleb and Mark Karpeles, and people want to hear from them because they know about them, having been the architect of the civil rehabilitation plan for the creditors of Mt. Gox, he is someone that's definitely worth listening to. He is extremely close to the case and he holds strong opinions on the processes and the key players. You definitely want to have a listen to this one. Daniel has worked tirelessly for the creditors and he is very clear about the outcome he wants for them. I really respect the guy. I really enjoyed this interview. I really hope you do as well. I got so much from it. And listen, if you have any questions like any of my interviews, you can reach out to me. We can discuss it. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. And also, if you enjoy these Mt. Gox interviews and you want to support the show, then I have a section on my website which explains everything you can do. If you head over to whatbitcoindid.com and click on the support section, there's loads of things in there you can do to help me with the show. And I also want to thank my Patreon top tier sponsor, vidyen.com, who create open source plugins which you can use to reward users with virtual items or store credit when they mine crypto in their browser or on your WordPress site. That is vidyen.com, which is vidyen.com. Okay, on to the interview with Daniel. I hope you enjoy it. Like I said, if you have any questions, feel free to reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. Good evening, Daniel. How are you?
Doing pretty well. How are you, Peter?
Doing very well. Thank you for staying up late for me. It's pretty late where you are, right?
Yeah, pretty late, but thank you for having me. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Not a problem. So you're aware, my awareness of Mt. Gox is probably not as much as everybody who was fully embedded in Bitcoin in 2013 and 14. I'm much more of a last 2 years person and, you know, fully aware of what happened and the impact on people. But based on recent interviews, I'm going down a rabbit hole that gets deeper and deeper and deeper. I've got no idea what it's like for somebody on the inside, but I think a really good starting point, Daniel, is for you to introduce yourself and explain your role in the Mt. Gox story.
Well, sure. My name is Daniel Kelman, and I was someone who purchased Bitcoin and traded at Mt. Gox and then had my funds there and they wouldn't give them back because of, you know, I wasn't KYC'd or all these things. It took them months to finally tell me they would give them back. And by then, of course, Mt. Gox was offline and no one could get funds out. So I ended up going into the Mt. Gox chat room, and in the chat room, everyone was just pissed off, angry, and I came up with this idea for like a debt equity swap where creditors would give up their debt they were owed for Mt. Gox for stock, and maybe we could recapitalize a new exchange. It had 70% of the volume in the world, And an investor liked it, a guy by the name of Olivier Janssens, and he sent me to Japan and hired lawyers, and we started looking into it. It didn't really pan out well, but I ended up in Japan, and I kind of just stuck with it and stuck with the case and kept following it, and it became a real interest of mine. And I met a lot of people in the space, and that's kind of how I ended up in the middle of Mt. Gox.
Have you ever publicly disclosed what you lost on Mt. Gox?
I think so. I think I have somewhere. I think I had about 44.5 Bitcoin, which to me at the time was a lot of money. And now it's, I mean, it's not nothing, but I've kind of written it off and moved on with my life in terms of finances, but I would certainly like to have it back.
Yeah, I guess one of the things that I've noticed, or one of the things I've became aware of, is trying not to reflect on Mt. Gox 2014 with Bitcoin 2017, 18, 19 eyes, because whilst it was a lot of money for people and a lot was lost, there is a very different feeling around a $20,000 Bitcoin and a $200 Bitcoin. Do you feel that happens?
Yeah, it happens. And people who were involved in the space back then, if they stayed in the space, many of them did very well. So people moved on with their life and maybe have a different perspective about where the industry is going. But if you were involved in Mt. Gox and you were taking it very seriously and very interested in what happened, and your reputation was tied up in it, you really want to see it through to the end. And there's a number of people in this same position.
Well, there's a lot to unwrap here, as I haven't stopped reading. And as I said to you on Telegram, every time I find one thing to read, I discover five more things to read. And finding truth is very hard because there's lots of conflicting opinions. Yeah, so we'll unwrap these. But just firstly, it would be very good to hear from someone like yourself what it was like back when the hack happened. Talk me through the kind of the days of when there was kind of a bit of suspicion that something had gone wrong, and then the news came through that, you know, there'd been a full hack. Can you talk me through that from the eyes of somebody who had Bitcoin on the exchange?
Yeah, so what I remember was there were rumors in the chat that people couldn't get their money out. And this kind of spread, and it spread to people actually only in Japan being able to get their money out. And then there was this Mt. Gox premium, where Mt. Gox Bitcoin was worth more than a Bitcoin on any other exchange, because people were paying a premium to withdraw funds in Bitcoin, right? I want my funds to be safe. I'll pay more for this Bitcoin just to get it off. So that was a sign to everyone. And there were a lot of people like myself who had funds and they wouldn't give them back for months. And people were pretty furious. I remember I was kind of in denial about it. I'm like, they'll give it back. It's not all gonna, you know, implode. And sure enough, it did. And when it did, it was just total like pandemonium. People took over the Mt. Gox IRC channel, which is where they, you know, they did all their customer relations. And it was, you know, all over the news, like mainstream news. It was a really, really big deal.
Well, it was the world's biggest heist at the time, right?
Mm-hmm. It may still be the world's biggest heist.
Yeah, I think there was a NEM hack last year that might have been bigger. I'm not too sure. And then obviously over the years, there's been different information about what happened prior to Jed selling to Mark. What happened in the handover process, and obviously there's quite a bit of work done by Kim Nielsen in analyzing forensically what had happened. As more kind of news has come to the fore, how do you feel about it all? And the reason I ask this is there are a number of exchanges now that have been created, but at the time it was the first exchange, and I wonder, do we look back at it with too kind of a harsh lens? Because I wonder if people really understood what they were dealing with at the time.
I don't think people did. Mt. Gox was totally different than any exchange today. And by way of example, for the longest time, Jed McCaleb banked all the Mt. Gox customers out of his own personal bank account at JP Morgan Chase in New York. Just think about that. Think about any exchange even trying to get a bank account today. It's really hard. And this guy was banking everyone out of a personal bank account. It was the only exchange in the world. It was charging fees that were like 0.6%. Exchanges now will charge like 0.1%. It was totally immature by comparison to what we have today. And it was a totally different world.
And how do you feel about Mark now?
Well, when this all happened, I hated Mark. I didn't know who he was. I wanted to go to Japan and find him and probably punch him if I could. But now I don't. I understand a lot more about what happened. And I believe that people, when they make mistakes, you know, there has to be a punishment for people doing things wrong. But there's also mitigation. People can do things to mitigate what they did wrong. And Mark has done a lot in the past few years to try to mitigate what he did that was wrong. And I'll give credit where it's due for that. Now, it doesn't fix everything that happened, but there's certainly some credit to be given there. And I also believe that in this story, you know, Jed created the exchange and had already been hacked once, and Mark gets it, and Mark's trying to fix it. And Mark has taken all the blame for it, whereas Jed has gotten out from under the entire thing. So, you know, I'm not trying to throw Jed in the mix or lay blame, but it's much more complicated than I think everyone kind of understands.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. Right, so we're, nearly 5 years on now.
Yeah.
But for a long time, we've been aware that there are funds that were discovered. So there were 200,000 Bitcoin. You're in a process, like a civil rehabilitation process, which is managed by a trustee. How do you feel about the whole rehabilitation process? And can you talk through it, what the process has been like for a creditor?
Yes. So about the civil rehabilitation process, I feel fantastic. But you have to understand where we've been and what we went through to get to where we are in order to understand why I feel that way. So the way bankruptcies work, there's two types of proceedings. There's liquidation and there's rehabilitation. And liquidation is where you just sell off everything and whatever's left, you give it back to the people who are owed money, the creditors. And rehabilitation is where the court takes certain steps to try to help the company get back on its feet so it can resume business and then be able to pay people back out of the future profits that it makes. Most bankruptcies start off in civil rehabilitation and it fails and they go into liquidation. This happened to Mt. Gox. They started off in civil rehab, we'll call it rehab 1.0, and that failed very quickly for various reasons, you know, and then they're in liquidation. And then in liquidation, everyone had to file a claim. And importantly, at the first creditor meeting, all the shareholders told the trustee, please, please do not sell the Bitcoin. We were terrified that he would sell the Bitcoin and tank a very immature market that had just gone through this massive hack. And to our surprise and to his credit, he listened. He didn't sell them. And this was in summer 2014. So for years, right, people had to file a claim in 2014. And then the trustee investigates claims and approves or denies them. And there was one claim that was never, that was rejected, but that wouldn't go away. And that's CoinLab. And we'll get into that. Mm-hmm. But because of CoinLab, 2014, 2015, 2016, 2017, no one can get paid out anything because we can't resolve this claim. And then in 2017, the price of Bitcoin goes from under $1,000 to $20,000. And this was incredibly significant for the Mt. Gox bankruptcy and the liquidation proceeding. And for this reason, when the case went into liquidation, people were no longer owed Bitcoin. They were only owed a certain value that was assigned to a Bitcoin. This is called mark to market. So the trustee took the value of every Bitcoin on the day of liquidation.
And that's to do with Japanese law, right?
This is to do with Japanese law, but almost any, I think in most anywhere, will any country will do the same thing, right? You file for liquidation and you have all these assets. You have to assign a price to them. So the trustee assigned a price of $483 per Bitcoin. So the value of the estate was just the number of Bitcoins plus 480, you know, multiplied by $483. And the trustee wasn't paying people back Bitcoins they were owed. He was just paying them back that value. So when the price of Bitcoin went to $20,000, we ended up with the absurd result that Mark Karpeles was going to become a billionaire. And all of that money was going, that was originally creditors' money, those Bitcoins that we convinced the trustee to hold and not sell in 2014, were not going to benefit those creditors. This was an absurd result. It never happens in bankruptcy, right? Because since when do you have like a company that has some asset that goes up by like, you know, several thousand percent and the company becomes solvent? It just doesn't happen, but it happened. And so we had to figure out a way to fix it. And we did fix it, and we can discuss that as well. But that's why I'm incredibly happy with the rehabilitation, because it means that all those surplus funds are going to creditors. They're not going to shareholders. They're not going to Mark or anyone else who claims to be a shareholder. That's all been fixed.
Mark has never wanted that money though, right? And neither has Jed.
No, they never wanted it. They both came out and claimed publicly that they don't want it. And Mark especially, he just wants this to go away and to get on with a normal life.
Quite interestingly, I read through his entire Reddit AMA the other night. And, you know, despite what anyone may think of him, he seems to be very humble, apologetic, and wanting to do the right thing. And actually, there was very little anger towards him in the Reddit AMA. There were plenty of people who'd lost money on Mt. Gox who were in the Reddit AMA who were actually saying to him, do you know what? I don't hold any grudge against you.
Yeah, I think he came out of his shell, I think, in 2016 or so and started to engage people. And it couldn't have been easy to do. But, you know, time heals wounds, and he made a mistake and has to move on from it, and people have to move on from it. And, you know, that's where we are, and good for him.
So have you received your dollar value of what you lost already?
No. No one has received anything back yet.
Right. And is this all being held up by CoinLab?
Yeah, Peter Vicenis. There are a few other minor issues, some related to the civil rehabilitation. But more or less, this would have all been done by now. I feel confident saying this would be completed by now if it weren't for Peter Vicenis.
And so what's his claim?
So this is, his claim is based on a lawsuit. And to understand this lawsuit, we have to go back in time. Back in time to the early days of Mt. Gox when Jed ran it. One of the first people to contact Jed was Peter. And Peter was very interested in Mt. Gox. And he emailed back and forth with Jed, and I believe at one point went to meet him in Costa Rica, where they discussed him becoming a partner, and he turned it down. Then Jed sold it to Mark, and Bitcoin went from like under $1 to $30. And then Peter came back asserting a fresh claim to ownership in Mt. Gox from his previous discussions with Jed, and this gets turned away. And then Peter goes away and thinks up a new strategy to take over Mt. Gox and gets what he wants. And it's his company CoinLab. And CoinLab is going to be like the US partner of Mt. Gox. Because at this time, there was no Coinbase. No one had figured out how to tackle the US market. And Peter had, in his mind, figured this out. And he cut this deal with Mt. Gox, where CoinLab was going to get 90% of all the income from the US business and Mt. Gox 10%. And they had an agreement. I think it was entered into in 2013, December, November 2013, something like that. And the agreement gave CoinLab 4 months, I believe, to be in compliance with all applicable law. And during this period, at the beginning of this period, it was pretty clear that among lawyers in the US who were anti-money laundering specialists, that you needed a money service license to do business from FinCEN and from elsewhere. And so a couple months go by and Peter doesn't get this license. And then FinCEN clarifies you need this license. Peter still doesn't get it. The period lapses. Mark and Mt. Gox don't want to give him the customer database, don't want to onboard CoinLab. And the whole thing ends up in litigation. And right as litigation is kicking off, Mt. Gox collapses. So Peter's entire vision, his third bite at getting Mt. Gox failed when Mt. Gox failed. And this turned into his lawsuit. And he tried to justify originally damages of like 100 something million based off the liquidated damages clause. And also using Coinbase as a valuation, saying he would have been Coinbase. And in the rehabilitation, when everyone had to file a new claim, Peter filed a claim that's the equivalent of $16 billion with a B, dollars, saying that he would have been more or less the new Coinbase.
Right. Okay. So to be fair, do you give any value to Peter's claim?
No. In fact, I give it negative value because Peter owed money to Mt. Gox. He started onboarding customers, and I believe he had at one point $12 million. And when the bankruptcy was filed in Japan and then recognized by the US, he was supposed to give that entire $12 million back, but he only gave back $7 million. So he still owes $5 million. And his legal claim, as far as I'm concerned, is extremely weak because he was required to be in compliance with all applicable law for the whole U.S. And he clearly wasn't. Not only that, he wasn't even close. He didn't have any of the state licenses that he needed.
So what is the legal status of the CoinLab claim and how long could this drag on for?
So in Japan bankruptcy, there I don't know the Japanese word, but in English we'll call it assessment. There's this special procedure called assessment where it's not in court yet, but it's between the bankruptcy trustee and the claimant. And they create like a record of submitting expert opinions and all this different evidence. And the hope is that they come to a settlement or they develop a record for court. And in the liquidation, this record was very well developed. And now civil rehabilitation is new and they're developing it fresh again. But to my knowledge, Peter Vicenis has filed with the court to have that record sealed, claiming that his life is being threatened and that sort of thing. So that's where we are. I understand the trustee wants to take this to court in Japan. And even though it's an issue of U.S. law, have a judge in Japan decided. And Peter, from what I understand, wants the case to be sent back to the U.S. where a U.S. court will rule on it. And I'm not sure when that gets finished, hopefully soon. I don't think anyone is really sure at this point.
But I'm assuming you don't want the trustee to settle.
No, the trustee should not settle.
Because you don't believe Peter has a claim to anything.
I think he has a very weak claim. And I think the trustee is right that a Japan court will dismiss it quicker than the U.S. I think Japan's going to look at this more black and white. Okay, it said you had to have be in compliance with the law. You didn't have the license. Throw it out.
Okay, but it seems to me that you've been pretty impressed with the trustee so far.
Some things I'm impressed with. Some things I'm not impressed with. Okay. We can get into to BitPoint and that stuff in a minute. But most other things, he's listened to creditors. He's been methodical and taken his time to do things right. He listened to, you know, to us when we didn't want him to sell Bitcoin. So aside from the whole BitPoint thing, I think he's been pretty good.
He did sell a bunch of Bitcoin in 2018, right?
Yes, that was BitPoint. So in 2018, the trustee, people noticed he was moving Bitcoin out of the Mt. Gox wallets. We could all see it happening. And people said, hey, the trustee's selling. That's what caused the market to tank in January. And the trustee correctly pointed out that, well, just because I'm moving coins out of a wallet doesn't mean I'm selling them. You don't know when I'm selling them. He did later announce that he sold, I believe, 35,000 Bitcoin and then 25,000 Bitcoin. But he didn't say how or who or when, because he may want to sell again. So recently, a website, GoxDocs, they retrieved documents from Tokyo District Court. And in these documents from Tokyo District Court, which any creditor can go and view, was a bank book that was the trustee's bank book that records all the money he receives and sends out as, you know, managing the Mt. Gox estate. And the bank book, if you look at the website, it starts on February 23rd. So pretty much at the end of when the trustee said that he sold the 35,000 Bitcoin, there's no real withdrawals in March or April. And then deposits. On May 1st, he starts getting a deposit almost every day from a company called BitPoint. And BitPoint, between May 1 and June 4, sent 22 wires, very large wires, to the trustee. And GoxDocs reasons that the reason he was receiving a wire every single day was because the trustee wanted to reduce counterparty risk. He told BitPoint, the moment you have my Bitcoin, and the moment you sell it, I want my yen. So that if you get hacked, I don't have to worry about the yen you just you're holding for me being a part of your bankruptcy. And so based on this, they looked and saw that the price of Bitcoin in May, when the trustee was selling, really fell and fell like a lot, like from $10,000 to, I don't know, $7,000, $6,500. And based on that, it looks like pretty likely that the trustee sold on the market as opposed to selling in an auction or OTC, as he was suggested to do by Jesse Powell, who was his original advisor.
Yeah, Jesse's quite tied to this, right?
Yes. Jesse's role goes way back. When Mt. Gox was hacked before the big one in 2014, he went to Japan from California and like helped them harden their system and fix it. And then when the big hack happened, Jesse, his exchange Kraken, became the official advisor for the trustee. And he's very passionate about making sure that this works out well for everyone.
Next up, I talked to Daniel Moore about Mt. Gox, the civil rehabilitation plan, and his views on Brock Pierce and Peter Vecenis. But before that, I have a message from my show sponsors. So let's talk about my new sponsor, Kraken, again. I'm obviously very excited about this. As I mentioned when I announced the sponsorship, I've been approached by so many different exchanges, and I didn't want to be recommending a new exchange every few months to my listeners. It's kind of pointless. It kind of loses meaning. So I wanted one exchange relationship, and there was just one natural choice for me. It was Kraken. Jesse has been a big supporter of the show. He's actually a patron of mine, which is kind of weird. And if you listen to my interview with him, you'll find out the backstory to that. So I approached Jesse and I pitched him the idea of me having an exclusive exchange relationship. I said I wanted it to be Kraken. He was up for it. And so yeah, they signed up pretty quickly. So I was blown away by that. And the thing I love about Kraken is they aren't afraid to speak their mind. And you'll know that if you follow Jesse on Twitter, even if it gets them in trouble. And that really resonates with me because I like to speak my mind and gets me in a bit of trouble sometimes too. But I'd love to hear from you about Kraken. Are you a customer of theirs? Have you previously been a customer? When did you last use the site? And have you checked out the badass refresh of the website and their new brand? It'd be really great to hear some feedback. Feel free to drop me an email. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. And yeah, check it out at kraken.com, which is kraken.com. And let me know what you think. And on to my other lead sponsor, BlockFi. And this week, I've been reminding you of some of the most important things about them and why I am such a big fan of them. Today, I want to talk about another reason why I love them. And something worth noting is that I get approached by advertisers all the time, and some I reject. One of the main reasons is I don't like the company or don't believe what they're doing is creating value or will last. I don't want to recommend nonsense. But I do love a proper crypto company, one which is creating products or services which creates value for users, and BlockFi is one of those. They are creating products which merge the world of crypto and fiat with their loans product, and they've got a whole bunch of exciting new things coming soon. So if you are interested in a crypto-backed loan, well, BlockFi is the leading crypto to USD lender. They service customers worldwide, including 47 US states, and their interest rates now start as low as 4.5%. They've always got an offer for you. If you sign up at blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid, you can get $25 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans for under $10,000 or $50 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans over $10,000, and applying takes less than 2 minutes. So you know the drill. Check out blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid, which is blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid. So was the trustee advised to sell using an OTC desk?
Well, we don't know. We just know what Jesse told him, because Jesse said publicly that he told the trustee not to sell. If he is going to sell, please consult Kraken, and Kraken would arrange an auction. And what we now know from the bank book is that he went to this company, BitPoint, which has their own exchange. And BitPoint, they may have sold on their own exchange, or they may have arranged OTC, but if they were doing OTC, it looks like whoever bought it may have dumped it right away. Perhaps they sold at some really low price that allowed the OTC buyer to then turn around and flip it for a quick profit.
Right. So outside of that, though, you're pretty happy with the performance of the trustee?
Yeah, pretty happy. Pretty happy so far.
And what are the next steps for the trustee, and how does the trustee also communicate with you, the creditors?
Well, he doesn't really communicate with us that much. Every now and then, every few months, 6 months, there's a creditors meeting, and anyone can show up. But obviously, it's in Japan and in Japanese, so not everyone, only a few people do. I go sometimes. I'll probably go to the next one. He distributes materials in English, and he posts them at mountgox.com, and that's how we communicate with him. And his next big hurdle is in the rehabilitation, and it's how to distribute the remaining Bitcoin. He sold some, and those Bitcoins that he sold and the Japanese yen that he now has is a sufficient sum to cover what was the value of the Mt. Gox estate in liquidation. So the only way we're going back to liquidation, from what I see, is if Bitcoin like goes to zero and there's no point in distributing anything. So it looks like we're in rehab and the trustee doesn't really understand how to distribute Bitcoin as Bitcoin. And he's soliciting, I believe, and from whom I've talked to, other licensed Japanese exchanges to help him figure this out. I believe Kraken wanted to do this, but legally Kraken doesn't have the license that was issued by Japan to do cryptocurrency business. So there's an issue for the trustee that it might be actually negligent to take the advice of to allow Kraken to distribute these coins, even though they may well be the most qualified party to do it.
Right. Okay. So now we have Gox Rising, enter yeah. Brock Pierce.
Yep.
I've actually seen mixed views on this, but mainly negative. Can you tell me your view on this, and then we'll go into the details?
I'm not really impressed, and I'll explain to you why. So Brock actually came to me very early on about this in mid-January, and he added me to a group called Project Phoenix with a few other people, and I started asking for details, and they didn't want to give me details. They just wanted me to give an endorsement for a speech Brock was giving in 24 hours, which I obviously didn't do. And he came back again wanting more advice, I think early February, and consultation, and wanting me on board. And I would listen, and I still didn't get a lot of details. And the more I looked into it, the more I was confused and didn't think this was a good option for two broad reasons. One, it became clear that Brock believed he actually owned Mt. Gox based off of a letter of intent that he signed with Mark back in 2014 when Mt. Gox was in rehab 1.0. And this letter of intent, we can get into it in a minute, is completely unenforceable. There's no way it's enforceable. It's on even weaker legal footing than CoinLab's claim, to give some perspective. And two, Brock doesn't seem to understand the significance of civil rehab. He steps in making claims about how he doesn't want to claim the surplus assets. He just wants to give them back to creditors. And this is factually incorrect and ignores the fact that creditors fought this long, painful battle to convert the case from liquidation into rehabilitation, which, by the way, was the first time it ever happened in Japan. So it was a total Hail Mary. And Brock could have, if he truly believed this letter of intent was authentic, he could have stepped in and sued on it during the liquidation when there was a lot of surplus assets and saved us from having to do that, but he didn't. And so when confronted with this, he kind of got very angry with me and accused me of being a secret agent for Mark Karpeles, which makes no sense because he's like accusing Mark of wanting to pocket the surplus assets and me having some backroom deal with him, when I'm in fact the architect of the civil rehabilitation plan that made sure those assets wouldn't go to Mark. So
yeah, I saw like an uncomfortable few tweets that came out between Brock and Mark, but also where Brock brought you into it.
Yes, because I guess he's just upset about the way things went, and perhaps, he's got to be a little bit desperate getting, you know, having the internet cheer Mark Karpeles on instead of him in a Twitter battle. So I don't know. I think what he said was actually libelous because I've never represented Mark Karpeles. I've never been hired by him. I've never had any loyalty to him. The only time I've worked with him, the only way I would work with him is if our interests were aligned. So for him to say that I'm his secret agent and been representing him for 5 years is completely false, designed to hurt my reputation, and actually perhaps actionable. So I wish he would issue an apology for that.
When you talk about having your interests aligned with Mark, your interests are really the interests of the creditors.
That's correct. To the extent that anyone is owed money from Mt. Gox and wants to get it back as Bitcoin and not have it sold and get Japanese yen back, I think we're in perfect alignment of our interests.
Okay, well, let's give Brock the benefit of the doubt for a moment, and then you can give me your kind of arguments against his proposal. But just for people who don't know or not aware, what is the proposal on the table from Brock?
Well, what he wants, he has a broad range of ideas. He wants to create a new exchange with the Mt. Gox brand, and he wants to give creditors 16.5% of it. And he wants to do an ICO. And this ICO will be like a, a debt recovery token where he'll fund some legal team. And this legal team will go out and try to recover coins and recover the lost Mt. Gox Bitcoins or sue people to get money back for the holders of these tokens. But the important thing to note about all these ideas is that while they may sound good, they're actually not necessary. Like, there's no reason to involve these ideas in the civil rehabilitation. He could just make a bid on the Mt. Gox domain and trademark and then start his own exchange and do all this on his own. Why even involve yourself in Mt. Gox in the civil rehab that's going on? So that part is not clear. And into the specifics of his plan, and you can talk to Kim Nielsen, who's probably the foremost expert on this, those coins are not coming back. They're totally gone. Ideas I've heard from his team, like going after people who got their money out in the 3 months before Mt. Gox went under, make absolutely no sense. Like, why would you gox, you know, some like class of OG Bitcoin user that got their money out, 3 months before it? I think it's just an idea that's not so well thought out.
What do you think Brock's incentives are?
Well, I think one, he wanted to bootstrap a new exchange with a whole bunch of people who are old school Bitcoin users, right? And get them incentivized to have his exchange do well. And I think two, he wanted to look like he was giving away all these surplus assets that he had a rightful claim to. But I don't think he understood that problem had already been fixed by creditors.
I'm of the understanding that is it a Telegram group?
Yes.
I've not been in it. I've decided to stay away from it because I think that's an extra rabbit hole I don't need to go down. But I'm under the impression that Brock has been advised by many people in that group to back off, as there is no support for his plan.
That's correct. There's a Mt. Gox legal Telegram group, which kind of evolved from the Mt. Gox IRC group back in the day. And these people are probably some of the most hard to win over people because they've been screwed over so many times by Mt. Gox. And they'll basically, they'll call bullshit the moment they see it. And they'll research everything very thoroughly. And that's exactly what happened here. And they boiled down everything Brock wants to do to its essence and said, you don't need to control civil rehab to do everything you want to do. So what are you really doing? And when they didn't get answers, they got kind of annoyed with him threatening to sue over that letter of intent and hold up the civil rehab proceedings even further.
So he is threatening to sue?
According to what I've seen on Twitter, yes. According to my conversations with him, I asked repeatedly, are you going to do it? Can you vow you're not going to do it? He never said he wouldn't. I believe he intends to, which to me is insane because that letter of intent is totally not binding. What he may be doing is just trying to use it as some kind of leverage to negotiate with the trustee. I don't know. But that threat of litigation has to be off the table for anyone in that Mt. Gox legal creditor group to even consider supporting what he wants to do.
I mean, is there any support? Is there anyone? Have you noticed then? Do you know what? Let's give him a chance. Let's hear what he has.
At first, everyone did. At first, everyone listened, and everyone talked about it and considered. And when they talked about it and considered and talked it all through, they realized, wait a second, why is this guy laying claim to the entire surplus of assets? Why is he, he didn't understand the current posture of the case and the significance of civil rehab, or he did and he was just lying about it. And so that hasn't been cleared up in that group, and Brock hasn't really addressed that. And frankly, from what we've seen, I don't think he really cares that much. I think he cares more about what the media and what people who don't really understand much about the case think, because that plays perhaps more to the reputation and goodwill angle, looking like he's giving away all these Bitcoins when in fact he doesn't even have a claim to them and that problem's been fixed.
Right. So I guess the hope now is that Brock backs off from this.
Well, look, if he wants to not sue on the letter of intent, if he just does that and says, guys, finish civil rehab on your own, it's going well, you've done a great job, I'm going to build my exchange over here, and I'm going to just give you equity, right? And I'm going to make a bid on the Mt. Gox IP, the domain name, all those things. He could, it doesn't affect his plan at all. He could do that. And I think if he did that, people wouldn't have a problem with it because he wouldn't be interfering in what people have been fighting for 5 years. But instead he comes along and says he's been doing this longer than anyone and that he knows more than anyone, and he clearly doesn't or is lying. And it really rubbed everyone the wrong way who had to fight against all odds to get the surplus assets away from shareholders and back to creditors. And they feel like they're being given no credit for that. And like Brock is asking for a pat on the back for giving people what's already coming to them.
I guess, and I'm putting words in Brock's mouth or ideas in his head, but I'm guessing if he was to separate building the exchange from the whole civil rehabilitation process, there's less of an incentive for him to have the ICO, which goes to look for the funds, and there's less of an incentive for him to give a percentage of the company to the creditors, because it is just essentially he's just buying a brand to launch an exchange. But then he's launching an exchange under a name which is hugely tainted by a person who does have a questionable reputation in certain areas. So I guess he's probably, and I'll ask him this myself, but I guess he probably thinks it's more viable having all these OGs kind of looped in to some kind of procedure.
Yeah, I think that's the case. He gets all these crypto OGs in his exchange and gives them a stake in it, so they want to see it succeed. And the name, is tarnished, but has instant recognition. I mean, look, we're talking about Mt. Gox 5 years later, and it's not even a company that's around anymore. People hear the name and they know what it is. So I trademarks are resurrected all the time, and perhaps he sees value in that. Perhaps he also sees value in the story and wants to like write himself into the story as someone who stepped in and actually owned Mt. Gox and gave all of his claim away to everyone as the hero. But the time for him to do that was during the 4-year liquidation, and he never did. And creditors fixed it themselves. And for him to try to step in and rewrite history with himself being the hero when he had the opportunity to do it and didn't is kind of dishonest, if you ask me.
Right, okay. So that's two things now holding things up.
Yeah.
Is there anything else?
It's mainly those two things. If he were to give up the letter of intent, and if he were to give creditors, if he were to acknowledge that there are no surplus assets that he can claim, and he were, perhaps to... those two things are basically it. I think he's rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. The third thing I was going to say is maybe he has to, change his demeanor toward the group and the way he acts. But I don't think that's a real issue. It's mainly those two substantive things that has kind of pissed everyone off.
All right. So outside of that and outside of the CoinLab claim, what is the current status of everything else?
Well, outside of Brock and outside of CoinLab, the claims filing process for rehabilitation is almost finished. We did it for liquidation and we had to do it again for rehabilitation. I think February 14th, in like another day or two, it ends. And then the trustee is going to examine all the claims and make a decision on, which ones get rejected, which ones get accepted. Then I believe in late April, April 26th is the deadline for people to file civil rehabilitation plans. So anyone who wants to, has a plan on how to rehabilitate Mt. Gox, can file a plan to do so. And the trustee will consider all those and figure out exactly what to do. And then creditors, once all their claims are accepted, the accepted claimants will, I believe, be able to vote on a plan. And certainly the plan is not to actually reopen Mt. Gox for profit. It's just to open Mt. Gox and let it fund people's accounts or distribute Bitcoin to them and then put it back into liquidation immediately afterwards. The issue is just,
right,
what is the best way to give everyone back Bitcoin as Bitcoin?
Okay, so looking back on the last 5 years, how do you reflect on it all? Because it must have been, I don't know, it seems like there must have been times that are quite stressful, but also like, listening to you, it sounds like you've also developed a purpose out of this, some kind of very interesting project to work on. Do you understand my question?
Yes. As for my purpose first, when I first learned about Bitcoin, I had just moved overseas and I left my job in New York and was taking a year off to learn Chinese. And I discovered Bitcoin then and invested what little money I had right away. And I wanted nothing more than to have a career in the space. It's like all I wanted. And all of a sudden, I end up losing my money in Mt. Gox. And I meet Olivier Janssens in the chat. And I'm on a flight going to Japan, like right in the middle of this Mt. Gox thing. And I say to myself, you would have never expected to have been in this situation, you know, a year ago when you first learned about this. And I said, whatever happens in Japan, just give it your all. And if it doesn't work out, at least you walk away knowing you did everything you could. And so I'm still doing that to this day. And really my career and what I've built of it, I think came from losing those Bitcoins in Mt. Gox. And I really just want to see this play out to a good resolution, maybe to give something back, since I've done pretty well in crypto since then.
So did you reinvest?
Of course, yeah. I reinvested. I met a lot of people in the space. I kept working in the space. I didn't want to leave. I was passionate about this. And things were rough in, you know, 2015 and 16. But in 2017, I did very well. I think people who stuck with it all did very well. So I'm pretty pleased about that.
What kind of things are you working on now?
Let's see. In 2017, I'm a lawyer, so I had a number of clients in the space who had all these questions about ICOs, and I learned about that, and I did some ICO investing myself. And I have one of the ICOs I invested in was VeChain, so I ended up on the board of VeChain, and I started an exchange with a few friends of mine, my partner Nan Xiaoning. In Beijing, we have an exchange, OceanX, at OceanX.pro, and we're still in beta, but we're launching lots of pairs, and I think we have the most volume for any VeChain pairs of exchanges. So, I still have a law practice, but I gave much of it to my brother, who also works in the space, and I still work with him on that. But I'm trying to focus mostly on OceanX and Mt. Gox stuff, and you know, I'm just really happy that like every day I can wake up and do Bitcoin and crypto stuff all day.
That's good that you didn't become disillusioned with it all.
No, not at all. I totally got into this because I believed in the idea of decentralized money that's not controlled by a government. Governments in the past, you know, a few hundred years ago didn't control money. And why do they need to now? And the internet's here and the internet can give us something better. And I saw Bitcoin as that. And I realized that, you know, price may go up, the price may go down, but the idea stays the same.
And how do you feel about the broad crypto space at the moment? It's obviously been a crappy bear market. Lots of projects haven't shipped and have gone to the wall. How do you reflect on all of that?
Well, 2017 was kind of ridiculous. I mean, it was a year when anyone could, you know, spin up something on their computer and sell it for millions of dollars. And there was a lot of crap. And there were a lot of coins that deserved to fail. And there were a lot of investors that deserved to lose money for putting money into it. And I think right now we're seeing the hangover from that, right? And, you know, it's not really a regulated market. I mean, governments are trying to regulate it, but they can only do so much. And so in a market like this, where you have less regulation and more people taking lots of risks, the hangover is going to be bigger. So right now we have a hangover from all this fraud. And I don't want to say fraud. There were a lot of very good projects in 2017. There were some solid projects. And I continue to believe that those solid projects have a chance at succeeding. But the ones that didn't, the crap, that has to get shaken out. And, you know, I don't know how long we have to go, but I do know that crypto is not going away. It's here to stay.
Is Bitcoin king?
Well, that's a debate. I mean, I like Bitcoin. I like Bitcoin Cash. I like Ethereum. I like lots of coins. And just like in our, you know, you have US dollar, you have euro, you have lots of different coins that have different uses for different people.
Do you have any kind of closing comments, anything you want to end on, anything you want to say before we finish up?
Yeah, I would just say that what I think at the end of the day, what I hope the history of Mt. Gox is, I hope Mt. Gox is remembered for two things. I hope it's remembered for being the first time ever when Bitcoin was distributed as Bitcoin by a bankruptcy, by a court. They didn't have to sell it off. They could distribute it as it was. And it was a tacit endorsement by a government that Bitcoin is money and can function as money. And I think the other piece of Mt. Gox history that I hope gets remembered is that it was really the creditors throughout the whole thing, the people who were passionate about Bitcoin, the Bitcoin OGs who were involved in this from day one, who came together in a decentralized manner on their own and were able to influence the process to make sure the trustee didn't sell Bitcoin, to make sure the trustee, you know, for the first time ever took a bankruptcy from liquidation into civil rehabilitation to fix the process. And that it was this decentralized organization of creditors on their own that really pushed the case in the right direction.
Okay, man, that's a great way to end. Well, listen, I appreciate your time. I appreciate you coming on and doing this interview. How can people stay in touch with you? And do you want to hear from anyone? And if so, who? And yeah, how do they stay in touch?
Well, I'm on Twitter at Daniel Kelman, DanielKelman. And anyone who wants to follow me or send me a message, more than welcome. Look forward to speaking with you.
Brilliant. Well, thank you for coming on.
Okay. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so how was that? What did you make of Daniel? Did you find that as interesting as I did? I got so much out of that interview. While other key players in the case maybe have reputations to protect or agendas which are not entirely clear, something I've struggled with these interviews, with Daniel it really is. He just wants the creditors to receive the maximum payout from the available Mt. Gox funds and for the civil rehabilitation process to finish as quickly as possible. That is it. There's nothing else he wants. And with this bias, I found it very interesting to hear his take on the likes of Jed, Mark, and Brock, as well as the performance of the trustee. The lens he has over this case gave me a lot of clarity. So yes, I really enjoyed that, and I really appreciate Daniel for coming on. And I hope you enjoyed it too. Like I say, if you have any questions, you can always reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. And also, just want to say a big thanks to everyone who supports the show and everyone who's been sharing out the interviews this week. Whatever you do, whether you leave me a review on iTunes or whether you're a sponsor, I appreciate what everyone does to support the show. If you're a regular listener of the show and you want to help me, you want to support it, there's a whole bunch of things you can do. So firstly, just listen to the ads. The likes of Kraken, BlockFi, Cash App, not only do they help me produce the show each week, Kraken and Cash App paid for me to go out to Japan to record the video interview with Mark Karpalis. Without their support, I wouldn't have been able to do that. So give the advertisers a listen. But if you don't want to listen to the advertisers, if you want an ad-free version of the show and one without any of my nonsense, then head over to patreon.com/whatbitcoindid. For $5 a month, you can subscribe to an ad-free version. I've got like 82 people now. It's utterly amazing. And if you don't want to use Patreon, but you want to subscribe, I've got a number of subscribers who now pay by crypto. Just drop me an email. It's hello@whatbitcoindid.com. I'll give you an address you can use and I'll add you to the distribution list. And actually, I've had my first subscriber from Lightning. Somebody made me a huge tip on tipping.me. And yeah, that's pretty cool, isn't it? You might want to become a show sponsor. If you're interested in this, then please reach out to me. You can probably tell by today's show, I'm completely sold out right now. I've got no slots available for at least the next 4 weeks. But if you are interested, then get in now because everything is selling out, which is, by the way, which is absolutely amazing. So thank you to all my advertisers. You can leave me a review on iTunes or click on the subscribe button. Two very simple things that help the show a lot, help me with my ranking in iTunes. You can follow me on social media. I'm at WhatBitcoinDid on everything, on Twitter, on Medium, on Instagram. My personal Twitter is at Peter McCormack. DMs are open. Feel free to reach out to me. You can check out my website, which is www.whatbitcoindid.com, and you can subscribe to my newsletter. And most importantly, you can share this show out with your friends and family. Okay, so tomorrow I will be releasing my interview with Kim Nielsen, who was the creator of the WISEC report, which analyzed the data to understand the background to the hacks of Mt. Gox. It's going to be super interesting. We're going to get into the weeds. I'm going to go way over my head on the technical side, but I'm really looking forward to this one. I hope you will check it out too. And remember, if you want to reach out to me, my email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com.